We want to start on time, and it's not time yet. So does anyone know any science jokes, by any chance? No? Anyone make it 2 o'clock yet? Chris, it sounds a bit loud. Is it a bit loud? Okay? No? Yes, it's 2 o'clock now. Yay! Right, great. Welcome. welcome to everyone here today. Welcome to you if you're a regular here at Headington Baptist Church. A big welcome to you if you're not, but you've come along because you heard about today from through our publicity or from friends. So welcome to you. Let me just say what's going to happen. In a few moments, I'm going to introduce David Gregory and Andrew Steen. I'm going to sing their praises and list their achievements, which is a lot easier for me to do than them. So I'll do that. And then I'm going to ask them 2 questions, which are just to get the ball rolling, very quick questions. And then each of them will speak in turn. I believe Andrew will speak first, and then Dave, and then I think Andrew is going to say a few words after that as well. So we will listen to them sharing about their experience of science and faith, and then we will open it to the floor for questions. So it may be worth you already beginning to formulate questions. Maybe you came with them, which is great, or there may be things that they say that will provoke thoughts within you. So please do be ready to ask questions of them. So this is David Gregory. He is the president of the Baptist Union as of this month. In fact, this is his first gig, so to speak, and he'll be traveling the country and speaking at Baptist churches up and down the country. Now, David first became interested in science around the time of the Apollo moon landings. And I think he says that his early interest in science, in a sense, felt like it led him away from God. But then as he grew more interested, particularly whilst he was at Leicester studying physics and astrophysics, his science drew him back to God. You became a Christian at Imperial College in London while he was researching thunderstorms and went on to work for the Met Office for 15 years, including the European Weather Center. He then trained at Theological College in 2001 and has been senior minister of Croxley Green Baptist Church, which is near Watford, since 2010. David edited Messy Church Does Science, 100 Sizzling Science-Based Ideas for Messy Churches. And I am an owner and possessor of that book. It's very useful, and we've been seeing some of that in action over the past 2 days. He's also co-director of Messy Church Does Science. That's a project. And he contributed to the book Hoping God's Future, Christian Discipleship in the Context of Climate Change. Okay. Married to Carolyn, 2 adult daughters. Yep. You like reading, cooking, local theatre groups, mountain walking, holidays in Italy, yeah, for some reason, okay. Right. Ancient ruins and anything to do with, can you guess which program he's into, anyone? Good guess, Star Trek. Here we have Andrew Steen. Now, Andrew, if you're regular here, Andrew's known to us, of course. Andrew helps here with our children's work. He's on the Helps Run Alpha courses here and is involved with the WOW Science events. Did you know that Andrew Steen has his own page on Wikipedia? I must admit, when I realized that, I went and put my name in, but I don't have a page. But yeah, but he does have a page, which is fantastic. So what I'm about to say is drawn from Wikipedia, Andrew. We're in deep envy. Andrew is Professor of Physics at the University of Oxford, a Fellow of Exeter College, Oxford. He was a student at St. Edmund Hall, where he did his MA and DPhil. His major works to date are on error correction in quantum information processing. And there is a thing in that called Steen Codes, which I presume is named after you, Andrew. Yes. He was awarded the Maxwell Medal and Prize of the Institute of Physics in 2000. And his books include The Wonderful World of Relativity, A Precise Guide for the General Reader, Relativity Made Relatively Easy, and Faithful to Science, The Role of Science in Religion. So, and you're working on more books at the moment. 2 more? Ah, more in the pipeline behind those two? So, shall we welcome them? So, just two very lightweight questions, really, just to begin, and then I'll hand over to them. So, perhaps each of you in turn first could just say, what's the greatest highlight of your career thus far? The greatest highlight of your career thus far. David, do you want to?
I've had two careers. So, well, one's still going. I had my career in meteorology. I think the thing that I remember most fondly about that was at the end of my PhD, in the last few weeks, I tried to look at a problem which people could not figure out. And I had a look at it, and I couldn't figure it out either. But if I can't answer a question, they niggle me. So 8 years later, when I was at the office, mess office, with another, with a colleague, we went back to look at that problem. And we found a way of solving the issue. And it was about how clouds move wind around in the atmosphere. And we put that into the Met Office model and improved the forecasts. And actually, people didn't believe it was as simple as we had done it. So lots of other people started wondering about it as well. And they discovered it was as simple as we had done it. And so that kind of got used by other people in other places too. So that, in terms of my Met Office career, I think that's that and those papers were the most fun things. In terms of my church career, there are lots of things. But in my last church in Milton Keynes, I got involved in running parenting courses in a local school, and then because we weren't getting the dads, we did a couple of days called Men Behaving Dadly in the local school. And we thought we might get 25 dads come along, and we got 80 come along, which is nearly all the dads in the school. And I did science experiments. This was long before I was doing a messy science. I just did a science experiment for the dads and the kids. And I saw the deputy head the next day, who went to another church in Milton Keynes, and she said, "You do not know the impact that had yesterday. We had a boy who was in reception. His brother was in year two. He came in every day and would hide on the desks because he didn't want to be there. We do this day, and his dad comes in and spends the whole day in school with him and his brother doing activities." And she said to me, "The day after, different child. Different child. Wanted to be there, engaged." Now, that's a big buzz for me, that making that little difference, that difference in one child's life is really important. So, thank you.
Andrew, shall I repeat the question?
No, you don't need to. I'll stick with... You've got
that, haven't you? Sorry.
I think I've been asked to pick it up. So. Yeah, I'm going to answer the question, first of all, in the sort of science grid. I've thought a few images. I'll just flick through them quickly so you get an impression of the area of science I'm in. So I work in fundamental physics. That's just a picture of some apparatus. It's a small trap for single atoms. If you look in the middle of it, you can just about make out... It's not going. I'll be there. Would you like me to start again? Is that all right? Okay. So this is partly for the benefit of people who are not here right away. So my area of physics involves fundamental physics. So it's the study of the individual sort of building blocks of the universe insofar as we can understand such things. And we do it partly by looking at them one by one. So there's a little dot in the middle of this picture, which is a single atom of the element calcium. So the element which makes up large parts of our skeleton, but here we're doing physics. And what we do in this area is we gather little groups of them. There's a little picture there. And then we basically use a large amount of electronic and optical equipment to manipulate these single particles and find out what they do, or how we can cause them to do new things that they might not ordinarily do. This is just giving you an impression that this is an experimental area. There's some data, I'm not going to describe it in full. There we are, you can hear me. And the answer to the question about what I feel is my sort of achievement I'm most proud of is indicated by this picture. Obviously, this is a very technical picture. I don't intend that you would feel you understand fully what you're looking at. algorithm. It sort of gives you a flavour of a combination of mathematics and there's a little hint of electronics there. So what's going on there? It's a bringing together of two areas of science. So it's merging together quantum physics on one hand and information theory on the other. So information theory underlies the structure of the computers and computing information technology. But by bringing that in together with quantum physics, we've got a very sort of rich area of insight. And my contribution was to sort of see how to do that. So that's my main scientific contribution.
Brilliant. Now, you're not just a scientist, you're also human. So the next question is, what do you consider to be your greatest achievement outside of science?
So do you want to go first?
Yeah, you go first.
Oh, okay. So a question like that is, of course, hard to answer. I'm going to give a sort of sneaky thing. I'm going to give two answers, you know, a double thing. So the one that my...
So the answer which I felt myself immediately drawn to is not quite an achievement of myself alone, at least. It's more of a relationship ongoing, but which is perhaps the most valuable thing in my life. And it's my marriage to Emma, my wife, and together our role as parents of our three children. So I cannot claim to call that altogether an achievement, but nevertheless, I feel I have put quite a lot of myself into it, and I am happy with the outcome, let's say. Maybe my main achievement there was to pick Emma, you know, to pick a good one. Anyway, so that's one thing I would say. But I'd like to add another thought, though, which might surprise you, in the area of something I, looking back on, feel, yeah, I'm happy that I did that. And it's a question of sort of keeping going, keeping moving forward in the context of struggle. And in my case, the struggle was sort of long-term, low-level depression. So a sort of low-level problem in the area of mental health, but nevertheless, you know, doing what I can, keep going, you know, be creative and productive as far as you can. And I think I'm sort of through that. I finally got out the other side and look back and think, oh wow, you know, done that, you know, and I've got quite a lot to show for it, I think. Yeah. Thank you.
It's funny because I was going to say I've been married for 35 years this year to Carolyn, and we have two daughters, and I guess that's really special for me. And my daughters are wonderful people as well. They're both in jobs where they're trying to help people who are struggling in different ways in life, and I'm very proud of that too.
Andrew, then, we're going to hear from you first. Because this has been recording, they will speak from here. If it looks static, it's just for the benefit of the ease of recording, okay? So, Andrew.
Okay, so the intention of this event is partly to do with the little phrase I put there, the church's role as a champion of science. So we want to think about the idea that when we're part of the Christian community and part of the church, we should not see our role as somehow sort of off to one side of science. We should rather see it as part of our role, at least, to support and champion all good things that we have as a community and as a bunch of individuals to work the world forward in creative ways. So we should be a champion of science. And one thing I'm going to do in the next few minutes is explore ways in which churches can begin to do that. But I think maybe that's something we need to talk to one another about, you know, and how can we facilitate this role of being the true sort of home of science. And then also, I have in mind education generally, but to the age group that's more broadly secondary level rather than primary level. So I have some thoughts which will, I hope, either in this group or else more broadly, will feed into the sort of thing which a teacher in a secondary level classroom might want to do. But I think we all have a role in this. We might be a parent ourselves, we might be someone working in youth work, we might be a grandparent. We've certainly all got some sort of link to the next generation as they come through. So, before I go to that slide, let me just say there is now current in our culture very much the idea that
science has shown a vast amount of success at grappling with the nature of things around us and unpicking them, looking into them, explaining what's going on. And it's a tremendous success story. And so we've got to the point where people are beginning to say, more and more often, well, that's it, isn't it? Yeah, science, surely there's no area of our experience that science cannot go into and begin to grapple with. So what else is there is to say, really? You know, science itself is the whole of what we need. And this is felt by people in all seriousness. In our intellectual life, science will basically be the method by which we uncover all truth. So the thought I want to put to you is that whether or not you've had that thought crystallized for you, it's a very common thought in the atmosphere of our culture at the moment. And is it right? No, it's not right, and I want to show you why. This is the sort of image which sometimes people have about what science does when it explains things. So you see I've given a little picture there with the idea of physics sort of providing the groundwork of the universe, which if only we could understand it well enough, we would then have explained chemistry and the way molecules interact and so on. And if we could only explain that well enough, and we've grappled with that, then we've got biology explained. And we are biological, aren't we? So ultimately, we will have explained what we do all the time. You know, this picture of science. So this is the structure of science, or at least as it is imagined, without being very clear about it by large numbers of people. So what's the truth of the picture? What's a better picture? It's this one, where you see, I've just picked out a few areas of science. I've picked out physics, chemistry, and biology, and I've shown them there in a sort of a interacting network. They all inform one another. None of them explains the others fully, but they all have something to offer to each other. And you'll notice that in my picture here, I've added a little bit further by way of just other things that human life involves. I mentioned poetry, art, music, law, and history, but of course the list goes on. And I don't intend by this picture to imply that somehow science is the center and the others are to the outside, because this picture is just encouraging us to think about how science fits in. And you'll also know I mentioned that at the basic level of the natural world, we touch on mystery. So when we do our fundamental physics and those atoms I was showing you, well, I can tell you they're made out of quarks and electrons, and I can tell you a bit about what those are, but that's it. I don't really know how an electron manages to survive from one day to the next. You know, we touch on mystery at the basic of science. And of course, at the other end of my diagram, I'm reaching up to mystery again in our efforts to encourage one another to do our arts and our poetry. Those are all sort of reaching upwards also to something we don't fully explain or understand. And that's great, and this is a very positive picture. I love that we don't fully understand everything. It doesn't mean we should stop learning more, but this is a very positive picture of what science does. And in the middle of the diagram, you'll see I've used the word supports and then another word, enarches. So supports is sort of saying chemistry provides those things which enable larger complex things to have some sort of existence. But meanwhile, biology sort of reaches back onto chemistry and says something about what those things are. And the word enarches there is not a word you'll find in the dictionary. It's a reference to the idea of an arch. It's saying that one level of scientific explanation is maybe telling us about things like stones, so individual stones. So maybe in my analogy here, chemistry is telling us about the building blocks of things. It tells us about the molecules and how they interact. But when you put your stones together in certain ways, you can get an arch. And the question I want to put to you and to myself, and I'll answer it immediately, is does a thorough understanding of the individual stones get at and sort of really fully grapple with and tell us about what an arch is? And the reason that the answer to that question is no is because, after all, an arch can be an arch even if it's not made of, even if it has nothing to do with stones. You can make an arch out of wood or out of metal. So this is a fairly simple point, but the point is understanding those stones there is not irrelevant or a stupid thing to do, nor does it have nothing to tell us. But nevertheless, when we look at an arch, we are looking at a different sort of question. We're looking at what sorts of shapes are strong under compression in the vertical direction. And that answer is to do with the overall shape of the arch. It's not to do with the individual materials it's made of. So that sort of simple thought, I return to my picture now, is going on throughout science. Most of science is like that. So I would like to hope that a picture like this one might be sort of enter into the sort of thoughts of anyone who's got a more artistic sort of gift. And they might let's try to capture this sort of thing in an artwork. And maybe such an artwork could be on display in a local church as a way of showing we celebrate what science is as part of what we have, but we also have a reasonable understanding of where it fits in, and we're not making the mistakes of thinking that it's just sort of like a ladder. Okay, so that's one of my main thoughts for today, and my other one is this one. So this is a statement in words which sort of says, in words, more or less what my picture there is also saying. So it's saying the same thing again. I'll read it out and then I'll make a comment. So the embodiment principle. Science is about building up an insightful picture in which the underlying microscopic dynamics do not replace, nor do they explain, the most significant larger principles, but rather they give examples of how those larger principles come to be physically embodied in particular cases. The lower level and the higher level principles are in a reciprocal relationship of mutual consistency in which each illuminates the other. So my physics will tell me about the strength of my bones and my, what shall I pick? Art history will tell me about the creative uses of those bones which people before me have made. You know, these are different ways of contributing to the big picture. And my ambition is that this principle would become part of the standard secondary school science curriculum. I would like it to be the theme of a lesson plan. For one day's lesson, the children would really think about this hard and be led through lots of examples of it until it became really part of their education. So that is not being achieved in schools today, but hey, there's no reason why it shouldn't be in a year or two, if enough of us see the value of this way of thinking about science. Okay, that's it for now, and we'll hand over.
Thanks, Andrew.
So, shall I skip on? So, okay, great.
I've got a few more things that I can use if I want to.
Okay. Oh, here we go. Yeah, there. So, I, as well as being the minister in Crotsbury, I'm president of the Baptist Union. As president of the Baptist Union, you get to choose a theme for the year to share with our churches. And I'm using the theme Divine Windows. Glimpses of God through life, the universe, and everything. And if you are a geek like me, you will notice I've immediately plagiarized that from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Life, the universe, and everything. Hopefully the answer is more than 42. As it said in my little biog, I like ruins, which is why I like going to Italy, because there's lots of ruins to see in Italy, and we tend to go around. So living on the edge of London, my wife and I are members of the British Museum, and we enjoy going in there to exhibitions. And recently had an exhibition called Living with the Gods. It was an exhibition about almost the history of religion through human culture throughout the world in lots and lots of different religions. I got interested in science during the space race of the 60s. And so what caught my attention in the exhibition was towards the end, and it was this poster on the left in Russian. A few months before I was born, Yuri Gagarin became the first human being to orbit the Earth. And this is a poster that the Soviets produced after he got back down to Earth safely. Whether he said these words while he was in orbit, or whether at a press conference back on Earth. But the translation of the Russian is, there is no God. He may have been asked at some point, do you see God, Yuri, while he was in orbit? And his response was, there is no God. Well, partially, that's a bit of a propaganda exercise on behalf of the communist government. But contrast that with what happened 7 years later when the Apollo 8 astronauts, Erwin Lovell Borman, became the first human beings to leave Earth orbit and to go around the moon. As they went around the moon on Christmas Eve of 1968, as they saw the lunar surface and became the first people to actually see with their eyes what we call Earthrise, and they took this picture, the Earth rising above the lunar horizon. Nobody had seen that before. They took it in turns to read from Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In contrast to what Yuri Gagarin said, when they looked at the wonder that they could see from the spaceship, their thoughts were drawn to the Creator. The wonder pointed to the being that had created all of this. What interests me about these two moments in history is I wonder sometimes, as Christians, how we respond to the idea of science and what it shows us about the world. As Andrew has already said, there's often an assumption in our culture that our science says there is no God. And sometimes we buy into that and we kind of feel we have to resist it. Or do through science, does it open the window for us to say, well, maybe this shows us something about God? A sociologist, Peter Berger, in the early 70s, was thinking about how a group with a minority worldview responded to the majority stream of thought in a culture. We live in a world, especially in our Western world, where science is part of our dominant narrative. It's produced amazing results in our culture, healthcare, technology. It is successful. So people, in a sense, see this as a really important thing that shapes our lives. So how do we as Christians, who belong these days in our country and in Western Europe to a minority worldview of faith, how do we react to this dominance of science? And Berger suggested groups respond in three ways. They either surrender to it, they either try and dialogue with it or bargain with it, or they defy it. Actually, within the church, we have taken all three stances in recent history. Surrendering to it, I think that comes in two ways. Surrendering to it means that we strip God out of our theology and our thinking, and we end up with a very kind of a secular way of looking at religion, psychology, perhaps. The other way we surrender is we ignore it totally. We say, we're here, that's out there, we're just not going to think about it, and we'll just get on with what we know about our faith story and what the Bible says to us. Defiance is basically when we say, well, this can't be right, this science, because it's saying things that our holy book, the Bible, says are untrue. So we resist it. We say, well, actually, that's wrong, that's rubbish, and actually what the Bible says is right, especially about the origins of the world and the origins of human beings. That's defying it. Of course, there is a middle ground where we try and dialogue with it. And often that dialogue is defending the possibility of God and faith against what science says to us. Apologetics, in a sense, keeping open the window or keeping open the curtains on the window of science or the window of faith. And that's how we have a relationship. There's a lot of good stuff in that area, and it's important to do that. But I wonder if there's another way we can dialogue with science, and that is saying, well, maybe in the process of science, maybe in what science shows us about the world, we catch a glimpse of the divine, we catch a glimpse of God, a window through which we can gaze. I think our relationship with science has to go beyond apologetics. I don't think you can ever prove to somebody God exists through science. I think there are hints. Certainly for me on my journey through science, there were hints, but it wasn't the thing that brought me to faith fully. I think we need to talk about science and God, or God and science together, rather than versus, and find a better way of approaching this dialogue. I think other religions and other scientists who are involved in other faith communities might do this better than Christians do. Same exhibition, British Museum, one of the earliest artifacts there was this statue, a Hindu statue, Shiva, Lord of the Dance, a Hindu representation of the creation and recreation within their theology of the universe. And that didn't disturb me so much. That's part of Hindu religion. What disturbed me a lot, though, was the little comment at the bottom of the display, which says, this statue has been placed in the grounds of the particle accelerator at CERN. where they discovered the God particle. And it was placed there as a gift from the Indian government to mark the collaboration between Indian particle scientists, fundamental physics scientists, and those at CERN, because the Indian scientists said, when we look at the smallest scales in our universe in creation, there is a continual creation and recreation of particles, on and on and on. And this statue of Shiva, our understanding of what God does within creation, kind of captures something of what we see in our science. So for them, their theology provides a window for them to connect with science. The question is, if we were putting an artifact in CERN as Christians, what would we put there? You might want to ponder that. Come with an answer later. I think there are things about our faith, and there are things about science which do suggest some ways we might develop a relationship. Certainly wonder is one of them. I started to re-wonder about God on my way to a physics lecture in my second year at university, having been taught more about the wonder of the world and how things interacted together, the order there was in physics, I started to think, well, maybe there is a God behind this. And certainly, although scientists in their academic papers do not use the word wonder very much, in their more public papers and popular papers, that word crops up a lot, much more than it does in the artistic literature and comments about art. In our world, scientists talk about wonder. There seems to be, in our experience of human beings, a feeling of wonder about the way the world is. Some scientists will just stop there and say, well, that's the way it is. We connect to that. But for me, that wonder was a window through which I started to think about, well, maybe there is a God who brings about this creation, this order, this beauty. So I think there's a window there we could have a conversation with science on. I think science is about bringing order out of disorder. Science is about, you know, observing the world and then trying to make sense of what we see. We use mathematics to bring some order to that. But there is something about science which brings order out of disorder. And certainly within creation, there seems to be a lot of things that develop out of disorder. That order arises out of disorder or the mess. There are some simple things you can think of this. Think about a snowflake. Not all snowflakes are beautifully shaped and symmetric, but a lot of them are. Now, that doesn't happen because somebody sticks them together with glue at a molecular level. That happens as water molecules are moving around in the air and bump into each other and start sticking to each other. And in that process of sticking together, that shape, that order arises. It arises out of a rather random process. And that you can see at the scale of plants, you can see it on the scale of galaxies. It seems to be a principle which stretches right the way through the cosmos. So not only is science about discovering order out of disorder, but it's a principle we see at a large number of scales in our cosmos. And for me, reflecting on this, our faith, at the heart of our faith is a moment when order comes out of disorder. When in the midst of death, God brings life. We have a faith which sees order coming out of disorder at creation, as God orders the world according to his pattern. There's a connection there, I think. There's a conversation to be had there, between our understanding of how God works in our world and in our lives to bring redemption and what science is seeing in creation. And the third area about where we might connect with science is about play and creativity. Now, people think, I was talking to somebody this morning and they were saying about music and art, that's a creative activity. Actually, science is incredibly creative. Science is just as creative as painting a wonderful painting or composing a piece of music. You need imagination. You need creativity to do science, to come up with ideas to test and to think about. There is an element of play in our science. And actually, when you look at creation with its variety and its wonder, some theologians say, actually, God is a player. He loves to play. He loves variety. Nothing is the same. So actually, with our playful science, we're exploring the play of the Creator, the play of God. And that's part of who we are made to be. But although Andrew's talking about working with senior schools, I tend to work with primary school children, and I'm involved in this project called Messy Church Does Science. So we were doing some of this yesterday afternoon in your WOW Club. This is a cover of the book that I helped to write with other people. That's me as well. Dr. Dave, I'm called. That's me as a cartoon character. And we have in this book 100 experiments for churches to use with families to explore the wonderful world of science, because some of the children I find who come to my church, and I think it's true of your church, some of them don't like football. Some of them can't play a musical instrument or paint a picture, but they do like science. They do like experimenting. Even I met an 8-year-old yesterday who loves doing experiments at home. In my church, I've had 6-year-olds who just love science. And so once a month, I run a little science lab as part of what we call Messy Church on a Wednesday afternoon. Now, one of the values that Baptists have is to try and inspire others with a generosity of spirit to energize them to become the people they are meant to be. Some of our children in our churches may be meant to be scientists. So I think encouraging them is a good thing. Now, I grew up in the 60s, and I went to church, and I went to Sunday school. And in those days, if you were really good in Sunday school, and you came a lot, you got a prize at the end of the year. We used to be given books with a beautiful engraved plaque, you know, attendance, 1964 to 1965. So I've still got my books, and I treasure them, really. They used to give us Lady Bird books. Now, Lady Bird books in the 1960s were nothing like Lady Bird books today. I know I said I've been married for 35 years, but I do have next to my bed the Lady Bird book of How to Be a Good Husband, which my wife gave to me a couple of Christmases ago, actually. Yeah, I gave her the same year the Little Miss Sunshine book. So, you know. So here are a few of the books I was given as a child as I was growing up through Sunday school. First one was the Lady Bird easy reader book of Baby Jesus, the Christmas story. Beautiful drawings, very simple words. That was great. The next year, they gave me the Lady Bird easy reading book of the saints. Not sure what this says about this Baptist church doing saints. We don't do saints very much. The next one's interesting. This was kind of in the late 60s, and I wonder what this says about ecumenical relationships between the churches in my town, because they gave me the James I and the Gunpowder Plot book. To their defense, there's a bit in the back of that about the King James Bible and how that came to be written, so that was fine. And then I guess they started wondering, well, what does an 8-year-old like? What book shall we get him this year? So they dropped the religious theme, and they got me the Lady Bird book of the history of football. Now, the problem with that is that I was no good at football and not very interested. So, you know, it wasn't the greatest book to buy me. So next year, they dropped the idea of Lady Bird books. They went for bigger, glossier books. They bought me a nice book on cars, fast cars, you know, sports cars and things like that. The problem was I'm not that interested in cars. It's just a box of metal on wheels, as far as I'm concerned. So that didn't go down so well. But the next year, they hit it on the head. They bought me this. The Pernell Knowledge, Library of Knowledge, Prehistoric Animals. Who doesn't like dinosaurs? Yeah, I love dinosaurs. And it was a great book, and I've still got it. It's a bit out of date. None of the dinosaurs have feathers. We know some of them did now. Now, you may feel that's a risk, buying about a 9 or a 10-year-old a book on dinosaurs and evolution in a church. And maybe it was. Maybe it was. Because through my teenage years, I stopped going to church. I was more interested in science than God, and the two didn't go together. But I think looking back, they knew, they were starting to get to know who I was. They knew what I was interested in, and they were trying to encourage me and inspire me for the future. And the back of this book, at the final page of this book, it says, "We do not know how the dinosaurs died out." And I guess when that was published in about 1970, that was maybe true. We still don't fully know why they died out. But then it said, but maybe somebody reading this book will be the person who finds out. That is a really good thing to do, to inspire somebody to use their gifts to inquire about the world. So in some ways, that's what we're trying to do in Messy Church to Science. There was some research done about 10 years ago in two schools in the south of Nottingham. And not church schools, but the researchers went in. They talked to a class of 7-year-olds and a class of 10-year-olds about their experience of spirituality, their spiritual awareness. And what they found was that some of the children in those classes used the language of science and technology to express their spiritual awareness of the world and God. Not all church families, not all Christian families, the majority didn't belong to a faith community at all, but still they used this language to explore their spiritual encounters with the world. They talked about the wonder of nature. They talked about scientific discovery through the experimentation they were doing, the wonder of it all. And yet they also use science in probably ways that scientists in some ways don't do. They talked about science fiction and fantasy. They talked about transporter technology in Star Trek, being like being transported to heaven and things like that. They talked about imagination. They used science imaginatively. Now, imagination is part of science, but they were using it in a playful way to explore a spiritual side of life. I don't know if you watch children's television on CBBC. It's full of programs on science and science fiction. This is a constant feature of their world, and they're picking up this language and using it. So actually doing science within the context of a primary age group in church may connect with some of their way of looking at the world. In Messy Church, they talk about the DNA of Messy Church. They talk about it being one of hospitality, creativity, and celebration. I'm fascinated by the use of the phrase DNA. This scientific term has seeped so much into our culture these days to say, what's the essence of something? What is something about? So hospitality, well, I think by doing science in church with these families, we're saying, actually, if you like science, you're welcome here. Actually, we're comfortable with you taking an interest in science, and we want to help you with that. Creativity, yeah, we're using the gifts that some of these children have, their interests, to explore the wider world which they are going to live in, which they are living in, and maybe developing the gifts. And celebration, yeah, we are celebrating the wonder of the world that we believe God has made. And we do use the science experiments to connect with Bible stories and prayer and just reflect on the nature of life and God. And that seems to be something that some of these families love to do. Of course, it's the parents who ask the question after a few weeks, if they've not been before, after a few months. They normally pigeonhole me at some point over the meal that we have at the end of the session. And they say, isn't it a bit strange? Isn't it a bit strange that you're a minister and a Christian, but you're doing science? Because they don't really go together. I mean, that just says what we said at the beginning, this idea that they don't go together, which has pervaded our culture, which is quite strong and powerful. But it is an opportunity to enter into conversation and a discussion with them. And that's quite fruitful. I think what we're trying to say here is a way we can dialogue with science is to pay attention to what God's up to in the world and in the world of science, to observe the world. That's what science is about. To carry that alongside the revelation that God gives us in our faith in Jesus, and then maybe allow them to mix in the middle with a bit of imagination for us to catch a glimpse of God. I don't think this is new. I think this is what Franciscan spirituality was doing 800 years ago and continues to do. I'm just trying to think about it in the context of not just looking at nature, but looking at what science reveals of nature. So, thank you for listening. Andrew.
Thank you very much, both of you, for sharing. That was fantastic. I think probably for the purposes of the recording, if you ask a question, I'll repeat the question so that that's heard through the sound system. And then, well, you can both answer each of the questions if you choose to. So does anyone here have an opening question for us? Yes. Okay, so the question is, how do we harmonize scripture with...
how do you approach scripture
with
modern science ideas?
Okay, with modern ideas of nature. And second one again.
How far can the idea of
scientifically reputable? How far can intelligent design be scientifically reputable?
Okay, so I think we'll both say a bit about both questions. I will be brief on opening chapter of Genesis, but I will say something. So we approach that by a combination of, we don't completely put the science to one side when we read Genesis. You know, we do have it as part of our general things that we have to keep in mind when we read the Bible. But we're also very, obviously, we must be careful to think about what was the job that the text was trying to do when the people wrote it. You know, what type of written thing is this? And I think that many of us have come to the conclusion that really it's not so hard to answer that. You know, this is a theological text taking a real deep interest in the nature of the natural world, and sort of one of the lessons is, yeah, let's really think about the natural world and notice that it's got all these wonderful patterns and structure in it. But nevertheless, the main sort of drive of it is to say, this is God's creation. It's not a home of lots of little gods, you know. Yeah, the stars are just lamps, you know, just things that they're in the sky. You know, they're not the home of Marduk or whoever it is, some Egyptian god. You know, it's lessons of that kind which are the main thrust of that story of the 6 days and, of course, the seventh day of rest. And the use of the word day there, I do think, is what we call a literary device. It's just a way of capturing the notion of ordered, calm activity measured over a, you know, a sequence of steps, rather than, I don't think even the original community, I don't think intended that they would think of it quite so literally as people often have since then. So anyway, I've said I would say briefly about that, but that's basically what I think about the opening chapter of Genesis. I think it's a work of great genius and spiritual insight, and we sort of mistreat it when we push it into this sort of very literal picture. And I come to intelligent design now. So for anyone who doesn't know what that was a reference to, it's a reference to some work done sort of dating from, I think, the 90s. I might get my dates a bit wrong, but it's a sort of one or two scientists and philosophers really taking a serious look at biological evolutionary history and saying, is the standard picture of that basically wrong? You know, meaning, have they missed a really big ingredient, namely individual steps where things took place in a remarkably sort of brief, something coming together in a way which couldn't really account for in the standard paradigm of the way mainstream science has gone. Now, what happened is that mainstream science had a look at that. They said they looked at the examples that were given, the flagellar motor in the bacterium, the immune system in mammals, and they had another look. So, yeah, okay, so is this a counterexample to the standard mainstream Darwinian picture? And the answer is no, it's not. So I think what's happened is that particular set of ideas called going by the name intelligent design, I think is just genuinely a mistake. And that's it. You know, it's been looked into. It doesn't mean to say we haven't got much to learn. We've still got masses to learn about evolutionary biology. But that particular way of getting at it, I don't think proves to really give insight that will stand the sort of scrutiny which we do require when we do science. So that's my understanding of that. And I have read quite a lot about it. So do come back at me if you're not sure about what I just said.
I'll say something about intelligent design first. It's always... if you thought about those three ways we're going to relate to science, defiance and dialogue, I think intelligent design moves from defiance towards dialogue. It was an attempt to, perhaps in a more scientific way, to engage with the science of evolution, but include God in the picture somewhere. So I think that's to be commended. I think when I hear about intelligent design, there's a lot of engineering arguments, it seems to me, in it. They often talk about irreducible complexity. So that one of the prime examples is this little, the hair on the end of a bacteria, which, you know, is like a little electric motor. If you take one part away, it doesn't work. Well, that's true of our electric motors. You take the magnets out, they won't work. But actually, an electric motor that we build is made of iron and steel and inorganic chemicals, and they just do not spontaneously come together and produce interesting chemistry together. There's a big difference between those kind of elements and those kind of chemicals and what happens with organic chemicals, which seem to have an ability to actually reshape themselves in different ways, sometimes spontaneously. And so I think we're applying a much too engineering argument to the way we look at the world. We're assuming God builds something, and it's new, and there's an intervention there. I think biology works slightly differently to that. Well, in a big way, actually. The other thing I'd say about it is that it doesn't really take into account the timescales involved in the evolution of life. That occurs very gradually and very simply and very slowly. And actually, you know, it doesn't have to be perfect to work. If it was slightly less complex than we see the motor at the moment, maybe it was still going to work. So maybe there are steps in design. And we know from our engineering background, you know, Dyson Hoovers, for example, he's constantly trying to improve his motors and step-by-step changes. So maybe something like that can happen in the real world too. So I'm never that convinced about intelligent design. I understand why people of faith would want to go down that route to keep a space for God, in a sense. With regard to Genesis, I think what Sir Andrew said, I would agree with that. I think these are not scientific textbooks. People did not do science in the way we do science. They were very good observers of nature. It's intended for us to understand something about God and the world, that God is the creator, there is one God, and it's a God who brings order to life. It's a God who wants to have a relationship with what he creates. And I think that principle of the God who brings order, I mean, it's a principle that I've talked about in science, but you continually see it happening in nature, the order coming out of the disorder. And I think you see hints of that, which I think is a redemptive activity of God. You see hints of that in those Genesis stories. And that pattern reoccurs all the way through the Christian story. So I think, as Andrew said, it's a theological text, trying to get to grips with the way the world is and the way we experience the world, rather than saying this is how the world was made. And the literal interpretation of Genesis is quite modern. In the early church, they didn't take a literal view of those texts. Augustine certainly didn't take a view of those texts. The literal interpretations tended to come out in the 1920s. In the United States, when there was a big debate about whether evolution should be taught in schools. And actually, that wasn't the real debate. The real debate was the way evolutionary theory was being used in social policy, basically saying if you were at the bottom of the heap, that's where you were supposed to be.
Don't go into that unless you want to. We mustn't have to. We can't. Every question can go to a vast area, so I want to be guided more by yourselves. So where would you like to go next? We can have a bit more on evolution if you like, but, you know, let's see.
Can I just say, are you saying essentially God created a world that could create itself? Is that more or less what you're saying to us?
It doesn't create itself from nothing.
No.
It creates itself from what God has made. And I think, yes, that's the way I looked at it.
There is one of the days in Genesis where it says the ground produced plants, not God produced, the ground produced. So there's a hint there, but I wouldn't go too strongly on that yet.
Can we just see if there are any other questions related to this area before we move on to something completely? Dolph, is it? Yes.
What
So does, the question is, does this mean that before the fall, something like entropy didn't exist? Or, right, okay.
Do you want to do that one? Or do you want me?
Well, I think you've opened up a whole thing there about what was the nature of life on Earth before there were any people around. And is that... Well, sorry, say that again? Yeah, or when there were, okay. Right. Well, I think the reason I put it the way I did is that I wanted to be clear about the thought that these things, these are things that we, it's not possible to have certain, 100% certain knowledge about many of these things. However, it is possible to say we have very good reason to believe that something, and the thing we have very good reason to believe that life on Earth has proceeded according to the patterns roughly as we see them now for about 4 billion years. And during that time, animals were born, lived, and died. They suffered from illness and predation. There was plenty of entropy. I think that's the word you used. So as far as we can tell from the evidence, so, you know, we base this on what we look at. We look and we think it through. The world proceeded according to that sort of pattern ever since it started. Does that answer your question? Yeah. But, yeah, fine. I wanted to sort of say something further towards sort of putting God back into this particular story about life on Earth, if you want me to, but I'll wait for you to prompt me to do that.
I think this idea of entropy and kind of tying it in with the biblical story is a good question, and it's something that has troubled me. But I think, as Andrew says, throughout the history of life on Earth, there has always been death and decay. So how do you square that with those stories? I'm not sure if I would take them literally. In my pastoral experience, I've had people say to me when they face terrible things in life, a terrible difficulty in life, like cancer and things like that. I've had it said to me several times, I must have done something terribly wrong for this to happen to me. And that's how we react when bad things happen. For me, when I take that experience of our life today and I read those stories, I think they are a reflection that life is difficult. It is a life where there's pain, there is suffering, as well as joy and good things too. And I think those stories are trying to give some kind of understanding to me of why life is like that. Why, you know, what's the relationship between our actions and why we struggle in life? Now, sometimes there isn't a relationship. That's just life. And I think, but I think those stories for me are trying to encapsulate that question that gets asked to me today.
I think I'm doing very badly at rephrasing these questions, so I'm going to bring the microphone to you from now on. next question. Well, I'm going to ask one while you think about that. One of the things that's challenged me is I think of Stephen Hawking and the way he describes our solar system and our Earth and a very average sun in a vast universe, and talking about the timescales of the age of the universe and the age of our solar system and Earth. It challenges what I was brought up with, which is, a very anthropocentric way of looking at life. It's all about us. Is it all about us? Does the Bible suggest it's all about us? And if it, you know, and how does the scale of the universe and the timescales involved challenge that understanding?
If you want to
I think you picked up something very important there. The way the Bible is very centered on us. And that's not surprising because it's written for us. And it's written about us. But the universe is a very big place. And I think Stephen Hawking is, and people like him are correct. The sun is a pretty average star in a pretty ordinary part of a galaxy. And our galaxy is not the biggest and the brightest in the entire universe, of which there may be 250 billion galaxies. I mean, those kind of scales are too big to last. So I think we need to do some thinking about the fact that really
it's not all about us. And I think there's some creative thought that needs to be done. However, although we are ordinary and average, are a star and a place in the galaxy, there's something very special about us as people, as human beings. We do seem to have capacities beyond other forms of life on the planet. We have those capacities to question and capacities to wonder about creation and ask questions and actually to wonder what is beyond the materialness of our lives and our world. And that makes us quite special at least what we know of the history of the Earth. Whether it makes us unique in the entire universe, I do not know. I don't think we can answer that. But just because people say we're an ordinary place in the universe does not mean you say we're not significant. In some ways, we, out of all of the living matter that we know, are the ones who are able to express thoughts about spirituality and our relationship with God. And I think that makes us very important.
I'll just add a couple of quick thoughts. So if you plot the amount of sort of mass to be found on the various planets in the various galaxies, you know, you sort of have a little graph along, there's always a bit there and there's a bit there, because it sort of goes like this. This is just mere amount of stuff. But if you plot the amount of organized complexity, it's sort of like this. So my point is just in terms of the, you know, obvious measures of the richness of what's going on planet Earth, it far exceeds any planet that doesn't have life. That's not about to say that we know that there are no other planets with life. I think there probably are. And those would also be really fascinating and interesting places. But the point is, there's nothing wrong with the thought that, you know, we should recognize the value of the richness of life on Earth. And of course, if you went to a very large desert region and you explored hither and thither, and then, you found nothing living at all, but then in one little corner, you found a little plant growing, well, you'd be very interested, wouldn't you? It would be appropriate. And there's lots of other examples, principles of justice. You know, if something unfair has happened to someone, it doesn't matter if they're a little, humble little, no one's ever heard of. That doesn't matter. If it's unfair, it's unfair. They need, we should pay attention. And so there are lots of areas in which the appropriateness of bringing one's attention to bear is not in proportion to the size of the thing you're looking at. You know, there are other issues. It's sort of obvious, actually, once you think about it.
So the rest of the universe is not a waste of space, then? Another question. Chris, hang on. I said I'd bring it to you.
No, I was just going on to the pitch you had at the beginning, Andrew, with the arts and the music and all of those other sort of more emotional aspects as well, and how science can explain things. So do you just think a lot of that science just can't explain when it comes to those other emotional activities like the arts and music and things?
So Chris wants to know whether or not what I'm saying is the science cannot explain the other sort of things which we do as human beings. And the very reason you ask shows me that I need to sort of pretty much repeat the point about what this illustration is doing. What it's saying is you can take those stones apart and look at their molecules and their little graininess and put the molecules back together and make a stone till the cows come home. You can do that forever and you still won't have found out what a bridge is. You can even put them together to make a bridge and it will be a bridge. But what you learned about the stones, that bit of your knowledge does not tell you about the principles of the structure of this particular shape. This is a certain shape which has certain properties that make it strong under compression from the vertical direction. Now, in a similar way, and this is obviously an analogy, but in a similar way, you can do your biology and your chemistry forever, and you will still not find out why Keats is a better poet than, Ezra Pound. It will tell you pretty strictly nothing about that. And yet, Keats is made out of cells and things. So it's not that the biology has nothing to offer, and yet it doesn't have anything to offer about the poetry. It just can't do it. I can't speak that language. And I'll bring in another analogy. If you want to understand the workings of a digital computer, we've got one right there working as we speak. the study of the logic gates won't tell you about the nature of the programming language, such as the language C or whatever it's used to write the programs. So if you look at the logic gates, they never tell you about the functions and the subroutines and things like that. It's the different language. I hope my different examples are helping to push the point home. Is that helpful to you? Has that answered your question? Or?
No, it hasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, yeah. Now, that is another whole interesting thing which we could talk on. I think Dave wants to say something.
I was just going to comment on that, really. Yeah. It seems to me in the study of human development and culture and evolution, as soon as we start produce artifacts that we would call artistic, musical instruments, painting on the walls, there is an assumption actually within the science of that, that that's the moment when we become spiritual. I mean, that was the entire thing of that exhibition at the British Museum, that this creative art form is a sign of spirituality, in a sense. And that's quite a strong link that people make.
James?
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question about the history of this kind of discussion. I want to ask, if you like, a slightly negative question, so I hope that isn't a problem. But I remember getting into a bit of debate, and I have another friend who's a professor at NAWP in Leeds, who was also in this kind of a debate, which was talking about evolution. That seems to be the creation, the origins seem to be the one area where Christians and others seem to have had this problem, really. And the point he was making was that there was something of a step of faith there, and the point that I tried to make in some conference I was involved in was that I know many, many Christians who don't have a problem with an evolutionary process of understanding how things have come to be with their belief in God, but I don't know any atheist who can believe in a creator. And I got a lot of very angry comments back on that, because it's true. You know, you as soon as you have a creator, you can't be an atheist any longer, really. So I just wonder, do you have any sense that there is something of an agenda to try and force this wedge? I know we as a church have played into that, the hands of that agenda, to force the wedge to say, actually, there is an alternative and these are not compatible, so you must choose. You either choose science or God. Question mark.
Shall I walk slowly?
I think, we have a young girl. She's 10. She comes along to, I think she asked me into our Messy Church Does Science lab. She comes along to our Girls Brigade as well. And she turns up one Friday at Girls Brigade and talks to my colleague. And she says, I like coming to church. I like God. But I love science as well. And I think I'm going to have to choose. She's 10. So Lisa said, well, you need to talk to Dave. but, you know, she's been... thank you. She's having a conversation with her grandparents. She lives with her grandparents. And they've had this discussion. Well, we think you can't have either. You can't have both. So I don't know if there's an agenda. I think some people do have an agenda in this debate from the non-faith perspective. I think we have in our education system, with our separation of science and not looking at its interaction with the humanities and religious education, we force a separation there. And one of the things I sometimes do is go into GCSE religious studies classes and talk about science and faith. I had a very interesting reaction there, yet some kids say, no, I just don't get this. And they're the ones who don't go to church, you know. And I get the same reaction for some of the kids who do go to church, say, I just don't get this. And it's either or.
So it is a pervasive thing in our culture, really. And I think by, as I was saying, by doing it at an early stage within church or within our engagement with society, then we can provide a more balanced and I think we would think a correct picture. Yeah.
So James asked, you know, is there a section of our influential voices in the current culture that want to push the idea that science is wedded to atheism? Yeah, sure there is. There's a very strong voice of that kind. What happened is that in the sort of over a period of something like 300 years from the 17th century, science grew up in a very Christian culture and a Christian context. It then had to sort of find its way to be a bit broader than that, so that you could just be a part of the scientific community without any particular religious affiliation. And that took place more or less at the beginning of the 20th century. So what happened then was, I think, science was made into a more like a common land. You know, in land ownership, you have, you know, people own their own little property, and then you have the common land, which just means everyone has the right to graze their sheep there, okay? Now, we don't all graze sheep anymore, of course, but science became a common land. And I think what's happened recently is people have tried to grab hold of that common land and say, it belongs to atheism. But they've been able to do that, partly, I have to say, because the Christian community has been not very clear on, you know, what the better alternative is. You know, we've struggled to really put it into words why our version might be better than that. And I did want to offer you a thought whereby you can sort of have God come back into the evolutionary biology without going to the intelligent design version of that. So that's a picture I'm just going to click up, which James will make reappear. Thank you. So this one, yeah, okay. So in the context, I don't mind going back to evolution. It is one of the big touchstones here that people get worried about. So this just shows you some pictures of some trees, and there are different varieties of tree there, and what they have in common is that the tree trunk is pretty much round in each case. My point is it's roughly round. It's not square or triangular, nor is it a very elongated elliptical shape. It's round. So the question is, so why are they roughly round? And I think we all roughly know the answer to that. It's because round shapes are somewhat more efficient in the use of materials for a given strength. You know, the tree trunk needs to be strong enough to hold up the tree. If you want to use the available material reasonably efficiently, you'll end up with a round shape. And my point is that the fact that the round shape has that property is not anything to do with the evolutionary process itself. You know, the round shape is efficient owing to other things. It's owing to things coming out of mathematics and engineering and material science. So what the evolutionary process did is it went exploring this rich way, and it sort of found out ways of being alive, ways of having there be plants and animals. But what ways work are not caused by any Darwinian mechanism. They're caused by what can work. They're caused by a sort of higher level principle about what shapes are efficient, or in the context of our lives, what forms of social relation actually function. So these things are not sort of provided by evolutionary biology. They stand over it as things which the evolutionary process can discover. And of course, it did discover many of them. And it's a very interesting observation about our life more generally. I'll give you another example of a similar thing, that humans, when they're very young, have a natural capacity for language. We all have an innate ability to learn language. But the human baby will not learn any language at all unless others talk to the young baby. So we acquire that ability through having an innate capacity for it, sort of coming up from one direction, as it were. And then it's sort of enriched and blossoms as it meets with another thing coming from above, if you like. And we thus sort of call each other into the fullness of what it is to be a human being. This is, I think, a good picture of the way God sort of calls things into their richness that he's already made possible through their created structure. Anyway, so it's this both and picture. I hope that's helpful. Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah.
I mean,
Yeah, I don't know enough about the theology and the history there, but what I will just say is that there are some of us, I'm in a minority here, but some people, you know, part of the community, you know, in some manner reflecting God's image, are very sort of, the intellectual part of us is very big, and we need to really sort of see that what we are doing is reasonable and rational. So I came to faith mostly by reasoning it through. You know, I can't say wholly, but you know, reason can get you almost all the way, and then you do need that little final ingredient. So to trust that God is as Jesus showed him to be is a very reasonable thing to do, and you can just about convince yourself of that with a bit of help from others, you know, without actually believing it. You can come to see, oh yeah, that's right, that's sort of right, that is, that makes sense. But of course, that doesn't, you know, there is a little bit of a willingness also needed that comes. But you can reason your way to faith pretty much. But then, yeah, I admit, you know, you must make a commitment. And maybe we've lost track of this. I don't know.
I think it's Dawkins who talks about faith as being blind. You know, I think that's wrong. I think both science and faith are based on evidence, different kinds of evidence, actually. But I think sometimes they cross over. I think. The way we do science is observing the world. That's evidence. And then we try and make an order of that with our theories and understand what that observation means. I think with faith, actually, it's often the encounter with something which is beyond the rational at times. Now, I think there's a big rational part of that. I think we're given minds and the Bible's a written text, so that involves a rationality. But like Andrew said, for me, although science started me wondering about God again, the final moment was beyond rationality. It was an encounter with something which I still can't explain, but I know I said yes to it. And if you want to say that's a leap in the dark, well, maybe it was, but I found there's a great deal of light beyond the leap.
Got time for a couple of more questions if you've got the stamina for it. Now, Joseph here is very interested in dinosaurs and has written and published his book on dinosaurs already, which is an amazing achievement. Is it about dinosaurs?
My question is also about how atheists look at our views on things, and instead of evolution this time, it's more about Jesus dying on the cross for our sins. So one of my teachers at school, he's a strong atheist, and he was saying about why is it right that Jesus can take away our sins? Surely we should be responsible for them. And he said, why is it a good thing to believe that he's taken them from us when we should be responsible? And I was thinking, okay, I can't really answer that straight away. I need to think about that. So what do you think about that?
Do you want your dad to answer, or...? Who wants to start?
Yeah, it's a good question. Okay, it's a good question. I think that it may be that the person asking the question has got a sort of a somewhat of a grasp of what the Christians are saying about what happened to Jesus on our behalf, but I think probably they haven't quite got it, really, you know, quite understood correctly what we're trying to say. And then I would add, nor have any of us quite really fully got it either. You know, we do our best to help each other with understanding why that was so important and in what sense it liberated us. But we do often find that we're struggling to put it into words. But what I will say something like is the following, that God is saying to us that your situation is such that it's not wholly, it's not one in which you are sort of wholly on your own and can resolve the breakdown in the relationship with God. You know, you can't just do that. It's just not possible for you to do that. However, I, God, created you as, you know, with the thought that you would be in relationship with myself, and I've, God, I'm thoroughly committed to that and will do everything that is required in order to make sure that it can take place.
So I think your teachers perhaps slightly miss the point that much as we might like to take responsibility for our own choices, we're just incapable of fully restoring this broken relationship. But I think God does say, okay, the relationship is restored, but he doesn't then say to us, okay, so that's it, you no longer have any responsibility for anything. You know, that's not what we find ourselves doing. We find ourselves, I'm not sure how to put it, we are fully responsible for the decisions we make, and we do bear some of the cost of those decisions, or our nearest and dearest do, you know, when we go wrong. You know, they're not completely protected from the results of our faults. But God is sort of saying, but ultimately, I will guarantee that the damage you do is sort of limited. And I don't know, I haven't said it very well, I think. But I would like to say that the response you felt was the appropriate one, namely, oh yeah, that's interesting, I need to think that through a bit more. That's exactly right. That's exactly the right response.
Yeah. It's interesting, said that, you know, shouldn't we be responsible for our own mess, our own sin? I think, yeah, we should. We are responsible for it. But we can't fix ourselves. So that's God's loving response to us. He wants us to be fixed, wants us to be in a relationship with him. So he steps in, and that's how Jesus plays a part in that. Is that fair? Well, no, not really. But that's God, and that's love. You know, God embraces the pain of what we do, the pain of the brokenness that we cause other people, ourselves, him. He embraces that so that we can do better. I mean, that was how I became a Christian. Listening to a song one night in my room, a song about somebody who's messed up. And all I can say to you is God came to me, Jesus came to me and said, you're like that. But I can help you do better. So, you know, there was responsibility there. But he said, oh, I'll help you do better. So I said, yes. 35 years later, I'm still going. Still trying to do better with his help.
How are you doing? A couple more questions? Yeah? Okay. Okay. Does anyone else have a question? That's fine, Dolph, but you've already asked one as well. I was wondering if anyone who hasn't asked a question yet wanted to. No? Okay, I'll go to Dolph.
Could the likes of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle explain such thing as consciousness in a human being, or any living thing for that matter?
Did you get that?
I said to somebody before we began, there's a good answer to any question. I don't know. I think I've picked up there is people doing a lot of work on trying to tease those kind of things out. The problem is with it, I don't think you're trying to bring two things together which we don't fully know. I mean, although, you know, we can do great calculations with quantum mechanics, and you're the expert on quantum mechanics, right? But we don't understand quantum mechanics, do we?
Well, we sort of do, we don't.
Okay, but the other side of it is I don't think we understand consciousness. We don't understand where that arises from with it. Yeah, well, I can't answer that.
I'd like to translate the question into the following thought. Is the knowledge that we have now of the science of whether physics or biology or indeed neuroscience, is that sufficient that we in principle could make a fully correct model of the human brain? The answer to that is no one knows, and my personal opinion is no. I think probably there's more to learn, and our current science is not sufficient to explain the workings of the human brain. But no one knows that for sure. But I hope that answers your question. And well, I just, for everyone knows, we have in mind that we'll finish in a few, you know, sort of next 5 minutes or so. So just stick with it for another few minutes, and then we're done, okay?
Can I just say that I read a book on Holdy last year called Seven Questions Science Can't Answer. It's by Marcus de Soutoy, who's, I think, Professor of Public Understanding of Science at Oxford. It's a good book. I'd recommend it to you. But one of them, I mean, two of the chapters, one is on quantum physics. The other is on consciousness. And he's trying to explore what we don't know, what science can't tell us. I think he would say what science can't tell us yet. It's very interesting, though, he feels he has to bring God in at the beginning and a thread through the book and at the end of the book as well. But it's worth a read. Marcus de Sotoy.
So I was hoping that I might get an opportunity to bring in an illustration about the question about science and religion. So I will tell you my illustration, which I hope you know you might find memorable. So it's sort of a story. Imagine you're back in my family home, and my wife Emma's brought a birthday present for Joseph, who's with us here. Okay, he'll sort of find this amusing, I hope. So anyway, it's a funny sort of a birthday present, and I can't figure out what it is. It's some sort of wooden box, but it's a very odd-shaped box. And so, you know, I get to thinking, oh, it's not very useful. It's not much. You can't put stuff in it very easily. Or if you do, you won't be able to get it out again. And it's rather bulky and hard to carry around. What is this stupid present? Anyway, so I get to analysing it, and I do my physics and my... I can figure out that the wood is of a certain species of tree. I can probably date it. I notice that there are some metal wires on this thing, so I sort of measure them. I get the tension. I can get the metallic properties, you know, see what it is. I'm basically beginning to get a complete picture of this object, and I study it thoroughly. And I think, well, that's sort of an interesting sort of thing. I think I've got what that is. At least I've got a very thorough description of it. And I'm not quite sure why Joseph will like this thing. Anyway, then Emma produces another object. It's a sort of a wooden stick with bits of hair cut off the end of a horse's tail. Thinking, what's that for? Anyway, so then Joseph grabs hold of the stick with the bits of hair from the horse's tail, and he does this. Okay. So starts doing this sort of motion, and beautiful music emerges, and I can hear these lovely moving music is being produced by this physical object. And you see, the point is that I had a complete and thorough analysis of this object. And it wasn't until Joseph played it that I sort of saw what it was. Then I knew. Then I saw what it was. Anyway, that's my illustration.
Do you still have that question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So without just giving a one-word answer, and you've only got a couple of minutes, so it's probably good that I ask it last, but what survives after death?
Is this for a scientist or a theologian to answer, Owen?
Yeah. Okay. Well, my understanding of the Christian take on that is that we take Jesus, what happened to Jesus is our sort of touchstone. It's our evidence. It's not all of, but it's a large contributor. So what happens to us after we die is something like what happened to Jesus after he died. But that, my understanding of it is it's a sense in which we become part of a greater resurrection of on a vast scale. It's not that we suddenly go off somewhere else when we die. It's more that we sort of go into a dormant state. But that resurrection, that new creation, is promised by God, and it's being slowly brought about. And I think that's what happens.
You do.
Right. Well, I'm sure if you've got questions that you haven't asked, they'd be very happy just to answer them in one-to-one conversation. Thank you, Anna. It's a warm afternoon, so... Well done for your sitting here through the warmth. Shall we just say a very big thank you then to David Gregory and Andrew C. Very good. And if you stay around for 3.5 hours, you can join our evening service. Or you can go and enjoy the sunshine. Thank you very much for coming, everyone. God bless you.